Roundtable Podcasts, underwritten by Proctors, the Capital Region's premier performing arts center featuring the best in entertainment from Broadway and around the globe. Proctors.org.
When author Jeff Hobbs arrived at Yale University, he became fast friends with a man who would be his college roommate for 4 years, Robert Peace. Robert's life was rough from the beginning in the crime-ridden streets of Newark in the 1980s, with his father in jail and his mother earning less than $15,000 a year. But Robert was a brilliant student, and it was supposed to get easier when he was accepted to Yale, where he studied molecular biochemistry and biophysics. But it didn't get easier. Robert carried with him the difficult dual nature of his existence, fronting in Yale and at home. Through an honest rendering of Robert's relationships with his mother and his incarcerated father, with his teachers and friends and fellow drug dealers, Hobbs's book, The Short and Tragic Life of Robert Peace, encompasses the enduring conflicts in America: race, class, drugs, community, imprisonment, education, family, friendship, and of course, love. It's a great pleasure to welcome Jeff Hobbs to the Roundtable. Thank you very much for being with us. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm sure grateful to be here.
Again, the title of the book is The Short and Tragic Life of Robert Peace, a brilliant young man who left Newark for the Ivy League. I say this because it's always a weird thing to say. This book is amazing, and I can't tell you how much I enjoyed it, although you almost feel guilty enjoying a story like this because it is so tragic, and as the title indicates, the short and tragic life of this man. And I'd have to ask you, when you first met Robert and you arrive at Yale University, is there a sense that trouble could be brewing for this young man, that the odds were against him, or did everything seem, at least through your eyes, to be fairly rosy and looked like he could be on a good path?
I'm so glad you asked that first. When I met Rob the first time on the first day, freshman year at Yale, he was really quiet, very directed. He didn't say much. Didn't ask for anything, just sort of went about his business. And all I knew about him at that time from a very brief introductory phone call was that he'd gone to prep school, he played water polo, and he enjoyed hiking the Appalachian Trail. So I assumed that he was pretty similar to, your average Ivy League student, except for his skin color. He wasn't similar to your average Ivy League student. He'd gotten there the hard way, and I also found that he wasn't quiet either. He had opinions, and when he disagreed with you, he let you know it, and that wasn't fun. But he was academically capable, more than, and I think the reason he wouldn't let any of us know, how hard his growing up had been with a single mother who worked mostly in kitchens and his father in jail in a pretty hard neighborhood, was that he didn't need to qualify his presence in New Haven. Doing so, qualifying it as some sort of against the odds triumph, would sort of signal that he didn't belong, and Rob Peace belonged.
When was there a point through the years that you were together, was there a point where you started, as you said, you learned that he wasn't that quiet. So did you start to see aspects of his behavior and learn about his background that you found to be troubling?
I didn't worry, but I saw that he, as we got closer and became true friends, I saw that he struggled particularly with the entitlement that's inherent to a environment like an Ivy League school. He was working in the dish room of the dining hall once, and three sort of preppy guys got up without bussing their trays and sort of left a mess on the table. He asked them to take care of it, and they probably didn't realize he was a classmate and ignored him and left. And I think what upset him was that he couldn't do anything about it. All he could do was put his fist through the the dishroom wall, which he did. When he told me the story, that seemed like a pretty heavy reaction to a careless prep school slight. So I started to sense that maybe he was simmering a little bit underneath. He was also dealing marijuana out of his dorm room, quite a bit of marijuana. He didn't hide it, and you know, I never said anything about it. I partly out of fear. You know, I thought if I, you know, what right did I have to tell Rob what to do? And if I did, what if he, you know, got mad? What if he didn't want to be my roommate or my friend anymore? And in the meantime, you know, it seemed he didn't really spend any money, so it seemed like something practical and well-intentioned, something he knew how to do, and something that maybe he needed to do, and that he was either saving up for grad school or just building a safety net like he'd never had before in his life. And since this was just marijuana and we lived in a college dorm, it seemed safe.
It did seem, and you know, I guess maybe because you know the trouble's brewing, but when I was reading the chapters about your time in the dorm and the time at Yale, it seemed that there would be a change in demeanor when he would come from home. He would go home and then he would come back, and that's where often the drugs would come from. That's often where sort of the trouble, any trouble that he did get into, would sort of brew out of coming from that experience.
And actually, that's interesting you bring that up, because no one's mentioned that before. And ironically, when he came back from Newark, he would go relatively often, I'd say at least twice a month or more. Yes, to re-up his stash, he'd come back with a, you know, a Ziploc or two filled with a, you know, marijuana and orange rinds. I guess they did something to keep it fresh. But, you know, he'd go home and he'd check on his high school friends and his childhood friends and right. His mother, of course. And when he came back, he always seemed sort of recharged and like a little jolt of energy, like he'd, you know, like he'd had a cup of coffee or something. So it seemed like he needed to go back and just sort of get to his real life and his values and escape the bubble in New Haven.
How much
in retrospect, you could sort of see that as less than healthy as part of the college experience, but at
sure.
the time, you know.
How much did he talk about to you? Talk about his home life, the fact that his father was in prison, the fact that his mother was struggling.
He hardly mentioned his father at all. You know, which is a sadness that was very powerful as I wrote this book and learned just how close he was to his father. His father was arrested when Rob was 7 years old and convicted when Rob was 10 of a double murder. Before that happened, he was a gregarious sort of member of the neighborhood and spoiled Rob and did homework with him and continued to do homework with him even after he was imprisoned. You know, over the prison phones, they would go over his assignments. You know, didn't seem to have a bad word to say about anybody, and not many people seemed to have a bad word to say about him. But yeah, Rob said his dad was in jail for manslaughter early on freshman year and hardly ever mentioned the man again, and because he didn't, it was a uncomfortable topic to bring up. And I spoke to his father once. He must have called the dorm room freshman year, before I probably knew Rob that well. And, you know, I answered the phone, and he asked if Rob was there. I said he was out at practice or something. And he said, you know, tell him his father called, which I did, and Rob didn't really react to it. As for his mother, you know, he talked about her, and it was obvious how much he was devoted to her. As far as struggle, I think his mother had just through force of will and hard work had met all of Rob's needs and sent him to prep school, like I said before. And, you know, obviously her life was not easy, but I don't think he ever characterized it as a struggle. Aside from her, just I think the bigger struggle was that she missed him and was lonely when he was at college.
You write midway through the book, as the two of you graduated from Yale in 2002, you write, "I didn't wait to say goodbye to Rob. I figured that the nature of our friendship, the nature of Rob himself, didn't necessitate that final ceremony after all the ceremonies we'd already endured. The man hug, the firm grip, thumb, lock, hand, clench, half hug, the not quite tearful later on, man. Rob was cooler and easier than that, and he wasn't going anywhere. There would always be time," I thought. You saw him off and on. He was part of your wedding that came a few years later. And then just a few years later than that, the man is brutally murdered. How aware were you, and then sort of this is the second half of the book in which you tell the story, but how aware were you of what was going on in his life? Was it ultimately the end of his life where you started to come up with all of the questions?
Yes, certainly. And that is a great regret carried not just by me, but with a lot of people who knew him very well, but turned out to be very compartmentalized in his life. And he seems to have a real... And that might be part of the titular tragedy, is just how compartmentalized he was able to keep the different areas of his life. You know, we graduated, and like I wrote in the book, you think, you know, life is so long, and you'll have all this time, and friendships will carry on. And our friendship did carry on. We kept in touch, not often, but regularly. I considered him sort of a touchstone through young adulthood. And you said he was in my wedding, and the day after I got married, we moved to California, and, you know, spoke to Rob a few times a year, but my wedding was the last time I saw him alive. He was a groomsman, and yeah, then suddenly I was at his funeral with all these haunting questions just about what happened, not just since graduation, but during the 4 years I'd lived with him in college and the 18 years before that, you know, what happened. And, you know, a mutual friend, actually one of our other roommates from Yale, just finished the book, and he called me. And what he got out of the book, he said, was that we just all have to stay in better touch with each other. And maybe, you know, if we talked a little deeper and asked harder questions and talked more often, maybe you can't change a man's decisions, but you can just be more present. And yeah, I think that is maybe a value to take out of the story, just to be more curious about people, even the people you know the best.
The name of the book is The Short and Tragic Life of Robert Peace, a brilliant young man who left Newark for the Ivy League. The book is published by Scribner. It's beautifully written and does tell an incredible story and a tragic story. Jeff, thank you very much for being with us. I appreciate you sharing with us this morning.
Thank you so much for your questions and for having me.
Great pleasure. Thank you. Again, Jeff Hobbs is the author of The Short and Tragic Life of Robert Peace. It's published by Scribner. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.